Good evening, everybody. Shmuel Plotzker coming at you live from Cincinnati, Ohio, and our Gulf Manor Synagogue and our School of Jewish Studies. Pleasure to be here. Sorry we're starting a little bit late, but that's how it is sometimes. We are going to continue our study of Malachim Aleph, 1 Kings. We're in Chapter 6, and the funniest thing of all is that when I left off last week, I didn't write down where we ended, where our last pasuk was. So what we can do is, we could do a little bit of, I'm looking over here that we ended off on July 10, and that was obviously a long time ago. That was, we finished off chapter, verse 15, and we began verse 16. Last week, that's where we began, because it took off for 2 weeks. So you know what we're going to do? We're going to just kind of blitz through in English verse 16 and maybe verse 17, and that will probably account for what we did last week, because we're doing this kind of slowly. And then we're going to jump into a little bit more depth at verse 18. We also did verse 18? Wait, Mrs. Brunner was telling us that we also did verse 18 last week. Great. So, okay, so let's just do the English in 16 and 17 and 18, and then we'll do 19 and from then on in a little bit of depth. So here we go. Verse 16, now again, we're in 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 16. Talking about Solomon building the first temple. He built the 20 cubits at the end of the house with boards of cedar from the floor unto the joists of the ceiling, and he built it within for a sanctuary for the Holy of Holies, for the Kodesh HaKodashim. Verse 17, and 40 cubits was the house. That is the temple before the sanctuary. Verse 18, and the cedar of the house within was carved with knobs and open flowers. All was cedar, ain even near ah. There was no stone seen. Okay? So, I think so. Let's go take a look at the footnotes on 18, and that'll be a good entree for us into verse 19. So here's what the commentators have to say on verse 18. This is all very non-narrative stuff. It's very technical. We're trying to understand the creation of the first temple by Solomon and all the numbers and the measurements. It's difficult for me to wrap my mind around some of it. We just do what we can. The cedar of the house within was carved with knobs. There is al habayis penima miklas pekaim, says the pasuk, carved with knobs ufture tzitzim and open flowers. Let's take a look and see. They're going to give us a Rashi. This means those boards of cedar which he made for the house within to cover the walls of stone were carved with figured carvings and forms of fragments resembling knobs, pikaim. And then he gives me the old French word, which always helps me, le mosier, okay, in old French. That's very helpful. I mean, that's helpful, I guess, when you're in the 11th century, and you're living in France, Germany, and you either know German or you know some French, and you say, what's the word? Le mosier, that's a great word to know. 1,000 years later, for me anyway, not always so useful. I got a bone up on my old French, but in all events, that's what's going on. Boards of cedar, which he's using to cover the walls of stone, those boards of cedar, we're told, were carved with miklaas pekaim, figured carvings and forms of fragments resembling knobs. And the knobs are pekaim. And open flowers. Okay, and also, ufture tzitzim. What does that mean, open flowers? What does that mean? So Targum Yonason renders this cords and flowers in the form of chains, says Rashi. Cords and flowers in the form of chains.
Which Hebrew term is that?
Pitu'ei tzitzim.
Oh, okay.
Many of us are at a loss. I mean, I'm just doing what I can over here. There's no way I can wrap my mind, so I can't bring whatever very, very, negligible talent that I've got. It's difficult for me to kind of pontificate upon, cords and flowers in the form of chain. I mean, I don't know what to do with it. Okay, open. What is piturei going to help me out? What does that mean? So piturei, this is interesting. Rashi is going to give us this. It's an expression of chords in the language of the Talmud. So the word peturei is also going to come up in the Gemara, and I think we mentioned this last week, a Gemara Moed Katan 29a, quote, as the rope through the loophole, as the rope through the loophole. And over there in that Gemara Moed Katan, you're going to find that phrase, or that word petur or peturei. Speaking of, I just want to say, I'd like to just dedicate tonight's class, if I may, to the good health and the refuah shleima of Rabbi Reuven Feinstein and his Rebbetzin Sheila Feinstein. They were in a car accident. And I was at a wedding. That was the wedding that I couldn't make it here to the class a couple weeks ago, I think, by now. And that night, we got word that they were in a car accident. They were brought to a hospital, and Mrs. Feinstein was brought in for surgery. That went well 2 weeks ago, but I just saw an email from Rabbi Zvi Bell of the Agudat of Israel of America that she's had a setback. And Rabbi Reuven Feinstein's home, and he is slowly healing. But Mrs. Feinstein, Rabbi Feinstein, is apparently not doing as well as we'd like, and so we're asked to say Tehillim. I'd like to dedicate tonight's Limud HaTorah to her refuah shleima. May they both be well. Okay, so pituit tzitzim, open flowers, is how it's translated. The cedar again of the house inside was carved with knobs and open flowers. And now tzitzim. Let's see what tzitzim is all about. Okay, so according to the Judaica Press, quoting down Rashi, here's the quote: flowers, tzitzim in the Bible. The word is tzitzim. That's an expression of flowers, like the pasuk in Deuteronomy, in Devarim, it bloomed blossoms. I got to see that word. What's that?
Is that
Deuteronomy
17:23. Sure, Deuteronomy is a mistake. Because my midrash is in Korach, I believe. Uh-huh. So I had to say that. Also, in my Torah, graduation, so I know it was part of Korach.
Okay, well, let's take a look, if we can, for a moment, at Deuteronomy 17:23. Okay, class. Actually, we have a nice class tonight, thank God. So let's just see if he's correct at all in his footnote in the citation, Deuteronomy 17:23. If I can find it, I'll give you the page. Here we go. 17:23. It's going to be in Parsha Shoftim. 17:23. And there isn't even a verse of Devarim 17:23. How great is that? So you think it's number 17:23. Okay. Let's correct the Judaica Press. If you have a pen, use your pen. If you have one, please throw me one too. We're going to try to go over to number 17:23. Okay, that is an egregious error. Sending me to the wrong biblical book. Let's go. Give me 1 second. I'll find it too. Hopefully, 17:23. And we're on page 830, I think. Okay, 1 second. 17:23. Okay, great. Let me just read you that verse. Vayhima macharas vayava Moshe alo ha'edus. I'll read the whole thing. Vine parach mate aron the day's lady. Vayotze ferach vayotze tzitz vayigmol shkedim. Now, I'll do the English, and that's on page 831. This is the whole Korach, a rebellion. So we'll just cut to the chase. Verse 23 in English. On the next day, Moshe came to the tent of the testimony, and behold, the staff of Aaron of the house of Levi had blossomed, exactly as Moshe had said it would. It brought forth a blossom, sprouted a bud, and almonds ripened. By Yotzeitz, seeds, and it sprouted a bud. Vayigmol shkedim, and almonds ripened. That's how it was translated over here in the art scroll. But our phrase rest in peace is what we're looking for. Yes?
If you look in the actual Rashi text, he says Bamidbar.
Ah, you see that? You're looking.
It wasn't my Bakir's.
You just took a look at the Rashi inside.
Yeah.
Exactly what I should have done. Precisely right. Lashon Prachim Kimova Yotzei Tzitz Psi Bamidbar Yud Zayin Chav Gimel, and that indeed is exactly where you want to be. Does anybody have a pen that I could just please borrow for a moment? Because I want to just correct that. Thanks very much. Thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, so yes, always look in the Hebrew if you can. That's the lesson we learned from that. That is Numbers. Funny. Oh my goodness. Okay, great. Thanks. May I hold this until the end of our roll up and I'll write down where I am at the end? Great.
Sure.
So there's the pasuk. Wonderful. The Yotzei Tzitz. It bloomed blossoms. Translated together, it means, I'm continuing now in the footnote, translated together, it means, quote, cords and blossoms. I guess, is it fair to say, Peturei Tzitzim, Pekayim and Peturei Tzitzim. But Menachem, in establishing the roots of the words, is, as we said last week, the great grammarian, there were two of them back in the day, I think in Baghdad, in 9th century, 10th century, Dunash ben Labrat and Menachem ibn Saruk, or reverse the names of the fathers, but Menachem and Dunash, and they were very great grammarians, and Rashi had their information. But Menachem, in establishing the roots of the words, he related this word, piture, as we see, piture tzitzim. Menachem felt that the word piture, he writes piture, relates it to open, maintaining it as a biblical derivation, an expression of the phrase in the book of Exodus, the opening of the womb. Kimo yaftiru, Lashon Petarechem. So you see right over there, a usage of the word Petes Resh, meaning opening, Petarechem, the opening of the womb, in Exodus 13:15. And also, Pasuk in Tehillim, they open the lip, and that phrase in the Hebrew is Yaftiru B'Shefa in Tehillim 22, verse 8. So for Menachem, this is a known word. It's got usage in other places in the Hebrew Bible, in Exodus and in Psalms. And so it shouldn't strike us as an unusual word here in 1 Kings. It already shows up in Exodus. Opening. Opening of the lip. Opening of the womb. So that's what how Menachem looks at the word, to be an opening. Not necessarily blooming or blossoming. Okay, that's interesting. And then all was cedar. There was no stone seen. Hakol erez. Everything was cedar wood. Ein even nirav. No stone was seen. Says the editor, quoting Rashi. The Targum translates it as follows, quoting Rashi. All the house was covered with boards of cedar. No stone was seen. Fascinating. You got stone inside, but then everything was covered up with cedar wood. Carved with knops. What's that all about? Jonathan renders this, and engraved was a resemblance of eggs. Let's just see that. Let's just see that. In Yudches, Uglav Chesu Bein, carved with knobs, engraved with a resemblance of eggs. I wish I had more on that.
Round eggs, I think. Oblong, oval eggs.
Well, it has round eggs.
That's
the non-kosher species.
Yeah.
Or have non. They have the round eggs belong to the non-kosher species.
That's what we're told.
So in saying that the knobs, are shaped like. Nothing
to look into. It's just that they were round like.
The knobs were shaped like kosher eggs.
Oh, excellent.
Non-kosher eggs.
Yeah.
resemblance of eggs. He's saying unkosher eggs.
Yeah, snake eggs.
Uh-huh. Okay. Thank you all. The Mitzvah of Sion maintains it was a drawing of a fruit carved with knobs instead, meaning fruit, not knobs. Others suggest that they were pictures of animals and beasts. They were referred to as pikaim. That word is, of course, coming up. Miklas pikaim. Carved with knobs, some say fruit. Over here we're going to hear animals and beasts. They were referred to as pikaim, fragments. Fragments, because only the visible half of the form was engraved on the wall, according to the Aderes Eliyahu.
So one of the discrepancies in the different accounts sounds like a UFO sighting. We have people seeing three animals, fruit.
Yeah, we've got that's typical rabbinical weighing in on what the word pikaim can mean.
Down at the time. We don't know. Question interpreting the Hebrew.
Yeah, so...
How do you get a discrepancy between fruit and beast?
Because these are words that are not that common, at least not commonly used in the context of the Hebrew. It may be similar roots in Hebrew that they use to different beasts as they go. Somebody takes a well. Do you mean a well like a well of water? And it's like, well, they're feeling healthy. Is it a word that's like good? You know what I mean? And if you kind of found here that after the text is written, it might not be clear which meaning is. Yeah, that happens many, many times.
Right. Not so uncommon that we're just trying to figure out a very uncommon word. And so you're going to have a little bit across the board. Knobs, fruit, animals, hard to know exactly how that looked internally, but these are the theories that are being floated. Yishar koach to all for your help on that. And now let's launch into verse 19, Pasuk Yud Tes. Udavir besoch habayis mipnima hechin. He prepared a sanctuary, the devir, he prepared the sanctuary in the middle of the house inside. Besoch habayis, inside the house, mipnima, inside, hechin, he prepared. And what did he do in that sanctuary? What was the purpose of that? L'sitein sham es aron bris Hashem. To set there the Ark of the Covenant of God. And that was the purpose of the sanctuary. Let's go take a look at some of the mefarshim that we're going to have in the English over here. Udavir besoch habayis mipnima, the sanctuary he prepared in the midst of the house. His reference here, this is quoting Rashi, his reference here, now this is Rabbi Rosenberg talking, was not to the sanctuary itself, which was at the end of the house and not in the midst. The devir was, according to this, the partition called amatraxin. And last week, those of you who are with me, we took a look at this phrase, amatraxin, seemingly a Greek term. We took a look at it in the Jastro. It seems to, and it comes up in the, over here as well, again, in the previous page. According to this, this partition was only in the first temple, not in the second temple. It was one cubit wide. It derived its name, traxin, from the Greek, which when translated means a place which is both inside and outside. Again, this is the Rabbi Rosenberg, the editor of the Judaica Press, because of this function, because of its function to separate between these two areas. And others say it means that which encloses the articles of Sinai. Let me just make sure that we have the word that we're looking for over there. Second, 16, Tazayin. The Devir, again, the word Devir coming up. Okay. And in the Pasuk 16, it says, Vayibin lo mi bayis l'dvir l'kodesh ha-kodashim. He built it within for a sanctuary for the Holy of Holies. But apparently, according to I think Rashi, it's pretty clear that it's not so much a full-blown sanctuary, but rather some sort of divider, which divides from the inside to the outside.
Right.
For Rashi, it seems to be where he wants to go, and he gives us this this Greek term. He applies a Greek word, traxin, and I think it comes down to Gemara in a couple of places. And so Let me just continue. Let me just, for those of you who weren't here last week, let me just continue reading that footnote to kind of flesh it all out for you. So troxen, again, is a Greek word. It's a divider between inside and outside and so on. Others say that the word zavir means that which encloses the articles of Sinai, like the luchos, the tablets, the Aron Kodesh, the ark, and the jar of mun, of manna. See Rashi, and apparently the Tosefta on Yuma 51b and 52a. In the second Beis HaMikdash, in the second temple, there was no wall, but a curtain separating the sanctuary. The sages of that generation, of the second temple, were in doubt as to whether the cubit occupied by the wall was considered part of the sanctuary or of the temple. They therefore decided to make two curtains to occupy that cubit and thus avoid complications. Quoting the Tiferes Yisrael on the Mishnah in Midos, chapter 4, Mishnah 7. So if that's helpful, great. Nothing. In the first temple, you had this partition. In the second temple, apparently there were two curtains for the sake of clarity. We looked up the word troxin. Honestly, off the cuff, I think the gesture had a slightly different definition than the one that's just being brought down to us over here, a place which is both inside and outside. I think that the Greek that gesture was quoting was a little bit different, but be that as it may, the word zavir is coming up again over here, two psukim later, and according to Rashi, his reference here is not to the sanctuary itself, but rather a partition, and that was the partition known by that Greek term, ama troxin. Okay?
The sanctuary
was the back of the house, and this is not referring to the back of the house, according to Rashi, rather to this partition.
Right.
Now he's going to look at the word lasitain. That's an interesting word, because all you got to do is just give me the word latet or lases, however you want to pronounce it, and who needs the letter nun? So yeah, the grammarians are all over that. The final letter nun is superfluous. It is as though it was spelled la tate or la ses. Okay, so the nun is Rashi, my doctor, saying that. Yeah.
And just to point out that in later rabbinic Hebrew, the moral infinitive to retain, gave would give would be litain.
Litain.
See, languages, you know, they can permute in various directions, and this is again an unusual form, but in some way it almost pre-shadows the rabbinic form. That goes into quite an elaboration of grammar. I don't know that it pays to go through it. You know.
I'm not sure. I'm gonna do that.
Right. What is the Rashi? I don't know. So it would be a whole long, joke. Let's leave it at that. It means,
right. Nice to know. Thank you, Rabbi Volok, for that insight that that the rabbinic Hebrew is already being foreshadowed, if you will, by this phrase, lisitain. Okay. Yep. All right. And anything else over there? Yes. Let me just read you this footnote here on the Judaica. Our sages add an interesting comment at this point. The word, prepared, hechin, he prepared, the word he prepared, hechin, seems to indicate anticipation of some future use rather than an immediate need. Wow. The word lachin, to prepare, seems to indicate an anticipation of some future use rather than an immediate need. And now here he's going to go into something really unusual. Shlomo knew the temple would not be everlasting. He, quote, prepared, hu hechin, he prepared at the outset for the moment when it will be destroyed, when it would be destroyed. So I would write it. He excavated beneath the sanctuary a chamber large enough to hold the ark, which would be hidden there close to the time of the destruction. This chamber was hidden in deep and winding tunnels. At the opening, he placed a heavy stone, and on the stone, he placed the ark. And he quotes me Rambam in Hilchos Beis HaBechira, chapter 4, halacha 1. Also see the Abarbanel, also see the Radak. All that we glean from the verb hechin, he prepared. That is really something. I'm just amazed at all that, that we're getting that from that word, that we are effectively ascribing to Shlomo some sort of prophetic powers. He knew that at the end of the day, his sanctuary, which he was putting up, would not last forever, and it would come crashing down. And he therefore built and excavated deep tunnels, deep, hidden, winding tunnels. At the opening, he placed a heavy stone, and on the stone, he placed the ark. Wow. But what? Where? He placed the ark in the main living sanctuary, wherever people were. I mean, where do you mean deep in a tunnel? I'm not sure I'm getting this. Can somebody help me out?
I hope so.
Hope you can.
This is what we figured out last week, is that...
Even as we did this last week?
He dug a tunnel underneath the sanctuary. He covered the opening with a stone, the opening to the tunnel, the hiding place. And he placed the ark
on top of that stone. He dug deep tunnels underneath. Then he placed a big stone on top of those tunnels, and then he placed, to cover up the opening, and on top of that he placed the ark. You are definitely jogging my memory. Thank you very much. That might be a way to understand it. Hope everybody's getting that. Deep, labyrinthine tunnels, and on top of that, a very, very large stone he had placed, and on top of that, the holy ark.
Well, given that the Torah says we don't do what we're supposed to do, we will be scattered. And then given that it says that we will be redeemed and brought back, then upon it guarantees that we're going to be better among the nations. So, and Jeff told us.
So if we do enough digging on the Harabias and anger the local Arabs, we could find these labyrinthine tunnels, theoretically. Wow. We should think about doing that. That'll be World War 3.5.
I'm very troubled by Chazal saying that Shlomo anticipated, and they don't even say it's a something, that he anticipated as a definite event in the future that the Beit HaMikdash would be destroyed. And the reason I'm upset is not because, or troubled, is not because Shlomo was not in love, he certainly was, that beyond a question. But to go back a few prokim ahead, when the temple was finished, dedicated, I was looking for the pasuk. And I kind of found, this is Hashem talking to Shlomo in Perek Tes, and the crucial psukim begin with Dalet, again in Perek Tes, says, V'atam telech lefanai, and you, if you will, you know, walk before me with my ways.
Yes.
I cannot be for the middle of the earth, but for and keep everything in the church. I read you, who can't actually keep feeding laws and so on. And then, in return, plus okay, Baki Moses keeps him on the quality to a le'olam. Then I will establish the throne of your kingdom forever. Kashidi Barti, as I spoke to David, your father, saying, lo yikareit v'chol Yisrael kifeis well, that there will never be, you know, any interruption of the Davidic dynasty. If you don't obey the Torah and don't follow me, instead you turn your back to we and the virtue of Zara. So then, Pesuk Zion, the Kratias is so ill, we are, they are Masakram. Then I will, however you want to say, destroy, remove, exile Israel from the correct place which I have given to them. There's a bias, I say, he dusty, the Shri Ashalach al Panai, and the house which I have dedicated to my name, obviously the base of Migdash, I will cast out from faith or Israel, so we see them. And that rejection of a divine presence by Hashem will serve as a model before all the nations. So it's clear that Hashem is conditioning the any destruction on Bnei Israel's sinning. And it seems that Shlomo, even before this whole thing took place, this Nebuah was received by him. Was absolutely not convinced, apparently through some kind of Nebuah or Ruach HaKodesh, that the bias will be destroyed. And so all then that would cast aspersions on the very, very powerful message that Hashem gave him just shortly after this destruction, after it had been completed, to say that now, you know, you've done the job of the legate, dedicating it, now the rest is up to you and your descendants. Depending on how you act, I will or will not allow it to stay there. And now, and yet, some already anticipate the bitter end already now. So I have a problem with that.
I don't.
Fascinating. Let me hear, Mrs. Brill, what do you got?
Okay. Hashem is telling him this. But Shlomo HaMelech was a very wise person. Besides being a Navi, he's a very wise person. Well, he knows human nature. I mean, look, he himself had his faults. So it's not such a stretch. And again, I'm going to take you back to Chamisha Chumshei Torah, where Hashem says, if you don't follow, I will scatter you. But then he goes on to say, and then I will bring you back, which is already guaranteeing that we're going to be, almost a guarantee we're going to be scattered, because he wouldn't have to say, he doesn't say, if you are scattered, I will bring you back. He says, I will bring you back.
It might be that if you take the larger context of the psukim, I will bring you back is obviously tied to a scenario of having been scattered. You know?
Well, so this is true, but the explanation, you know, the foundation was already laid.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like he's hiding it. He's making provisions. So if it happens, it's provided for.
That would be okay. I would be okay with that, except I think the lashon, at least that is quoted in Chazal, is what I saw that in Radak. Let me just turn back. We're in
chapter 6.
Okay.
And we're right now on verse 19. Pasuk Yutes.
And that he understood and Ruach HaKodesh almost awaited for it sometimes if you keep up. Habayis Licharet, that the the result will be the actual end of the bias will be that it will be destroyed. And then it goes on to explain what it's talking about. So it's not as if, at least according to the way the Radak quotes Chazal, that he did it as a contingency, but that he saw the Ruach HaKodesh before Hashem gave the promise, you know, the beautiful day of the phenomenal spiritual time for Israel, and we use the positive, you know. It would be like almost they do it those that do the prenups, you know, when you know, you get married,
you know, let's discuss the divorce plan already.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a beautiful time, a very auspicious time to come to soil. And as I already said, I'm warning you if, you know, one way or another, but as long as you behave yourself, we'll be fine.
Right.
And then he already has talking to the marshal. Parent to the child, a very precious game. Something that the child really wants badly. And the parent says, as long to the child, as long as you behave yourself, this can be yours and it'll continue to be yours. But if you ever misbehave, I'm going to take it away. So the kid knows that he's going to misbehave. So he cuts all the secret, you forgot the word. You know, place where he hide out, hide away, where he could hide the toy when he's naughty, so it would still be around potentially for the future. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. That's kind of a muscle.
And Rabbi, can you please tell me where the psukim were that you were quoting? The later psukim, was it chapter 8 or chapter 9?
Did I say 9?
Was it chapter 9?
Okay,
thank you. Where Hashem is saying.
Begin more or less.
What is that
banging? I'm not saying anything.
Verses 1 through 5 or so. I'll establish it forever, establish the throne of your kingdom forever, and so on and so forth. Okay. Shka, Rabbi and Mrs. Brillo, thank you very much. Fascinating idea that Shlomo already was bavorned. As we say in Yiddish, he already anticipated that the temple that he was slaving over was eventually going to be destroyed. And he therefore made arrangements to be able to hide the ark and anything else that needed that was so precious that would need to be nignaz. And so he created these winding tunnels, placed a heavy stone, says the Radak, at the opening of that tunnel, and on that big stone, he placed the Aron Kodesh. Really fascinating stuff. Verse 20, okay, all that from the word hechin, he prepared. Pasuk Chaf, verse 20, v'lefnei hadavir, estrim ama orech, the estrim ama rochav, the estrim ama komaso. And within the sanctuary was 20 cubits in length, and 20 cubits in breadth, 20 cubits its height. Sounds like somebody at the door. Maybe somebody banging at the door to try to get in. That is an unusual bunch of banging. Is it Tyler trying to get back into the building? No. He knows the combo. Hold on, people. We're going live over here, but we can't understand. Oh, it is. We've got fireworks. That explains a lot. You heard these banging and banging and banging and banging. What's going on? Okay. I don't know. And what's the reason for it? We've got some Cincinnati fireworks. What's that? Fascinating. I have now at least you have an explanation.
Are they doing it right in their backyard?
Yeah, seems so. Backyard.
Maybe you think you should call the police on
them? I'm in the middle of but I'm in the middle of this, and I'm sure it'll be done soon enough. And I'm sure that the police, who are half a block away from that,
are aware
of it because you can't help it.
Yeah,
I think so. But at all events, that might explain the bang, bang, bang that we've been hearing. So within the sanctuary was 20 cubits in length, 20 cubits in breadth, 20 cubits. In height, by its apeles of sagor, he overlaid it with pure gold. By its safnizbeach ares, he covered the altar with cedar. Okay, let's go ahead and take a look at the footnote or so. That's how we kind of do it over here. within the sanctuary, v'lefnei hadavir, within the sanctuary, literally before the part of v'lefnei hadavir, for Rashi, it doesn't mean within some sort of sanctuary, but rather in front of the partition. He says the word devir means a partition. That is, within that partition was an area of 20 cubits long and 20 cubits wide. So says Rashi. And 20 cubits was the height. That is to say, again, quoting Rashi, according to the simple and literal translation, the height of the room of the Kodesh HaKodashim was lower than that of the temple. Quoting Rashi, the height of the room of the Kodesh HaKodashim is lower than that of the rest of the base of the Mikdash. And Rabbi Rosenberg continues, he says, this is an apparent contradiction to chapter 6, verse 2. That was earlier on in our chapter. Let's just take a quick look at that. What's up with chapter 6, verse 2? And the house which King Solomon built for God, the length thereof was 60 cubits, the breadth thereof 20 cubits, and the height thereof 30 cubits. Okay, so the height of the Beis HaMikdash apparently was 30 cubits high, and this sanctuary, according to this, was, I thought, yeah, 20. So, okay, so Rashi seems to be on some solid ground. Now he's writing, this is an apparent contradiction to chapter 6, verse 2, where the height of the entire house, including the sanctuary, including this Kodesh HaKodashim thing, is described as 30 cubits. He's being very strong on the idea that back in verse 2, the whole temple, meaning every part of it, was 30 cubits high. So now what in the world is this? Where you're getting 20 cubits for this? It should be 30.
Remember we kept talking about maybe there was a drop ceiling because it was, yeah. there's always this discrepancy between 20 cubits and the 30 cubits.
Well, there is
So maybe that's what it is. On the outside it was 30,
but
on the inside it was only 20.
Right. You're bringing me back. Thank you very much. Right. Our sages explain this to be referring only to the area above the highest point of the Kruvim, the cherubim. That is, the unoccupied space above the Kruvim was 20 cubits. The height of the sanctuary itself, however, was 30 cubits. They also conclude that although the Kruvim obviously occupied some space, there were still 10 unoccupied cubits below the Kruvim. There were then 10 cubits below, 20 cubits above, and the Kruvim in between. Yet together there were no more than 30 cubits. Although this is a physical impossibility, one of the many miracles surrounding the ark made this passable. See the Gemara in Baba Basra 98b. Wow.
I wonder what the Rambam and other rationalists take
Yeah, you know, I don't know. Did he believe, did the Rambam believe that there were miracles that took place in the Beis HaMikdash on a regular basis? Doesn't the Mishnah say that?
The Mishnah says...
In others. So what would he say?
Well, you may know those miracles, maybe you would have to say, I don't have to see. I know one of those miracles is brought down that you know, the coins up and never saw too much carry.
Yeah.
In Yom Kippur.
In Yom Kippur.
Yeah.
Right.
So it's brought down that it did happen once during the Second Temple, and that only refers that Mishnah to the First Temple when things were more miraculous, so I don't know what that says about the other miracles, but that doesn't answer the question. It sidesteps it. You know, there are clearly miracles seen in the First Temple, but in terms of the structure, and I don't know what the Rambam would even say about with the Mishkan when there was a certain, there aren't no space at all. The Rambam would say, where the Sadegon would say, I don't know if there might be a way to allegorize it or rationalize it. I just don't know. But it would be interesting to look it up.
Thank you.
We look at the space of the fever, but I don't know. These things are probably... See, I have a problem. How much of what we know in the Torah about the mitzvahs that refer to building the Mishkan and everything that's connected with the Mishkan, how much of those were detailed just how often for the Mishkan, and how much carried over for the Doros, right? It would seem that each of the two temples, most probably the three, probably Herod, I'm sure, was quite different than what had preceded it. They took what was the essential elements that could not be changed without very, very strong justification, but then the physical structure that housed them was rather flexible, I think. I
said
that it has to be explored.
Scott, thank you. And I was going to quote down a Radak. Others suggest that the 20 cubits in height referred to here was the gold covering. As the very next words in the pasuk indicate, we're going to get there in a second, which reached up till 20 cubits in height. That is that a typo? I mean, are they repeating that for emphasis? I'm not sure why that is unusual. Okay. Okay.
One who has however manually answered it, or
right.
You
know, exactly right. Okay. 20 cubits in height. If you continue, pure gold, okay, it was overlaid with pure gold. Zahav, Vaitzapeu Zahav, Sagur. What's the word Sagur? Now, we know the verb to score means to close. That we know. It's a contemporary, maybe modern Hebrew term, but I'm sure it's got some Hebrew biblical roots. Let's go see what, if anything. Pure gold. Our sages explain the Gemara in Yuma, 45a. Now, Chazal explained this unusual word, sagur, meaning closed, to describe the gold in this way. Quote, at the time this type of gold was opened to be sold, all other stores selling gold were closed because of their comparatively inferior quality. So that's why the usage of the word sagur, closed, is used over here, because this type of gold that was being sold was superior. All other stores selling gold were closed because the other stores were selling inferior quality gold. Wow. But Jonathan rendered this good gold. Targum Yonason, v'hachafahi dahava tava. He covered it with dahava. Of course, the Zion and the Dalet are interchangeable. And in the Aramaic, you can have a Dalet. Hebrew will have zahav. Aramaic will have dahav. Dahava tava. You're going to have... So he covered it with good gold, according to the Targum Yonason. Good gold.
See, I'll explain how sagur can come to mean good. You look at the Tzion, sagur wrote the Lomar, and his car, the Kuretzareth, that was enclosed in the purified, whatever the right word is, his furnace, right, of the gold.
Smelting?
Smelting, right. The Taharom seeks to purify from any, you know, impurities.
Mm-hmm.
Because it had been closed up in the furnace for most probably longer than typical gold.
I like that. I like that. That's helpful. Closing up the kiln, if you want to use that term. My kids go to the pottery place, so they paint stuff and then they have it fired up. So this firing process gets rid of impurities, whatever, and you're left with a nice product. And that would explain why you have this term, pure gold, zahav sagur, because as the Mitzvah says, it was closed up in that kiln in order to get rid of any bit of impurity, and then you're left with really good stuff. Thank you, Rabbi Brola, for pointing out the Mitzvah's tion over there. That's great. He most likely, we're going to continue on now, quoting down a Rashi perhaps, he most likely meant to translate the word Sagur closed. Now, referring to this is Rashi, I think, on the Targum Yonasan. He meant it as follows. He who has any of this gold locks it away for himself. He is Sogair. He closes, locks it up for himself because it's really good quality stuff. But I like the Mitzvah best of all, personally. That makes a lot of sense to me. You close it up, this kiln, and you fire things up, and you get really high quality gold. That to me is, I'm not the biggest smelter in the world, but that works, I think, if you can.
I was coming back to the 20 cubits versus the 30 cubits.
You are on that. You're fixated on that. Go ahead.
Okay. Earlier, in the beginning of the chapter, it talked about lower chambers and a staircase to go up. So maybe the height of that chamber, which is like upstairs, is 20 cubits. And the lower chamber being 10 cubits gives you a total of 30 that you would see from the outside.
Mm-hmm. You would, is it fair to say that you're walking up 10 cubits of maybe steps and then you've got a 20-foot space, 20-cubit space? Okay. We're trying to figure it out.
Right.
Thank you. Shkayach. In between the fireworks, trying to learn this up. Excellent. Thank you very much, Rabbi Mrs. Berler, for that. Okay, good. We're not done yet. We're not just done yet, though, with that pasuk. Let's finish off by Yitzach Mizbeach Orez. He covered the altar with cedar. With cedar wood, he covered the altar. Let's go ahead and see what there is to see on that. We'll see the Rashi in English for time's sake. He covered the altar with cedar. That is the golden altar used for the burning of incense. But I am perplexed. Why was that of Moshe hidden? Says Rashi. Let's see the Hebrew original. Let's see the Rashi if we can. And see what, if anything, he means. By Yitzach Mizbeach Arez. He covered the altar with cedar. Says Rashi, who Mizbeach HaKetores? That's the Mizbeach of the incense offering. Utmeani, I am shocked. I'm surprised, astounded. The Shel Moshe Lama Nignas, and the Mizbeach of Moshe, why was that hidden? I need a little bit of help over here. Obviously, there's a Mizbeach of Moshe that was floating around, and we're not talking, he's not using that anymore. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, the default here that that most of the Kalim, or the furniture of the Mishkan, were just a continuation of the ones that had been there all along, like the menorah and so on, and the other mizbeach. Well, I forgot which mizbeach is which. The ketores was on the zahav or on the nechoshes?
Zahav.
It was zahav, and he's covering that up with cedar now.
That's the one that's on the inside.
So he's building one, a fresh one. According to Rashi, this is an all fresh production. He's putting together a golden mizbeach, but he's covering it up with cedar, and he's saying, what happened to the Moshe Rabbeinu one? That should have still been around through the years. It was extant in the Mishkan. And so why did he not use Moshe Rabbeinu's Mizbeach in his holy temple? You'd think if you're going to use anything, you're going to use that with that which Moshe made. And Rashi is astounded. He doesn't have an answer to his own question. I'll take any and all stabs at an answer on behalf of Rashi. Anybody?
By the way, you want a further question? Isn't all kinds of wood, including any kind of wood, including cedar wood, flammable? I don't know.
The actual bath itself was made with wood, which was coated, overlaid with gold.
But this needs to be the opposite. No, right? So what does it say at the end of...
I understand. Right. That's my kasha on.
Right, uh-huh, right.
But it was gold. It was overlaid with gold, both inside and out, I believe.
And this over here has an exterior of cedar wood.
Which I don't understand, but...
And Rebola was saying, but if that's flammable, what are we doing with that?
And how are we using it? Maybe the top where the fire was would be contained and it wouldn't, because it wasn't the big, where you were burning behemoths, you're just burning incense, you don't need such a big fire that maybe that doesn't spread to the other
one.
See, I'm confused because we didn't do kafes yet, right?
No.
What kafes, how that relates, that there was the oven is red or what?
Okay, I'll tell you what. Let's just see this footnote over here that quotes me a radak, and we'll start wrapping it up for tonight, and we'll keep everybody excited about next week. Radak agrees with Rashi. This was not that of Moshe. This Mizbeach, this Ketores Mizbeach, was not the one of Moshe. Since that was made of acacia wood overlaid with gold. Moshe's was acacia, and it had a gold overleaf. This seems to be a gold made with a wood overleaf. It's completely opposite. Rabbeinu Yeshaya insists this was the very same altar made by Moshe in the desert. Shlomo overlaid it again, first with cedar, then with pure gold.
Because we didn't see black ones
there. Right, we're gonna finish up.
That may be, and you take the whole thing together, the
Vilna Gaon, Nederes Eliyahu, explains very simply that Beis HaMikdash was twice the size of the Mishkan. The latter, the Mishkan, was 10 by 30. And the former, the temple, was 20 by 60. He wished to double also the size of the Mizbeach, which was only one cubit square. He made this enlargement. He made this enlargement by first adding cedar and then overlaying it with gold. See Rashi. Not sure. But that's the Vilna Gaon's attempt to explain it. He was doubling the size of the Beis HaMikdash, and he wanted to double also the size of the Mizbeach, and he did this enlargement by first adding cedar wood and then overlaying that with gold. So according to this pasuk, he overlaid it with pure gold. One second. In the sanctuary, 20 cubits height, and he overlaid it with pure gold, and he covered the altar with cedar. But according to the Vilna Gaon, he covered the Mizbeach with cedar wood and then overlaid it apparently yet again with gold, according to what he's writing over here. So that's all I got. That's the attempt. That don't leave it, according to this, the Vilna Gaon is saying, don't leave it as the Pasuk seems to leave it. Maybe I'm wrong, but the Pasuk seems to leave it. Oh, he overlaid it with cedar wood. Says the Vilna Gaon, yeah, on top of that, he added gold, nachamal. It was gold again. So don't leave the pasuk where the pasuk leaves itself. He added yet gold more on top of the wood because he was trying to double the size of certain things. The temple also was doubled, and this particular item is also being doubled in size, if you will. So that's where we are. Hopefully this is helpful. If this is just a mere review for some of you out there, well, there's nothing wrong with a little chazara. We don't do enough of that. If this was indeed fresh material, then I'm happy about that. We're ending off over here at the conclusion of verse 20, and God willing, we'll pick it up next week with verse 21. I want to thank everybody for coming out. Thank you, Shikar, Rabbi, Mrs. Bro. Thank you so much for your insights. Here's your wonderful pen, and thank you. Wishing everybody good night, and with God's help, this Limud HaTorah that we did, the small bit that we did, should be to the Refor Shalema of Rabbi Reuven Feinstein and his Rebbetzin Sheila Feinstein. Should both live and be well.
Interesting, now of speech, you read.